Well, now our other main topic today, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch, who's out with a new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. He was last on this program in 2009 discussing his book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. Taylor Branch, welcome back to Up to Date. Always good to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be back in Kansas.
Well, you're glad you're not here today, Taylor. It's a little rough out here.
Yes, I hear you've got a little snow. We normally have that. I hope you get through it all right, safely.
Well, I think we're getting there, but it's going to be a long day, I think, for a lot of folks here. But let's turn to your book, because you've been so done so well with this series of books and obviously winning the Pulitzer Prize. You say in your latest book, The King Years, that the civil rights movement formed the basis for our divided politics of today. I'm wondering what the connection is there as far as you're concerned, Taylor.
Well, in 1964, which was the great pivotal year of the civil rights era, the year that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed, racial politics was strong enough to turn the partisan structure of American politics upside down ever since. Democrats had always, for a century, been the party of segregation in the South, and Republicans had been the party of Lincoln, that housed many African-American members from what was called the old Black and Tan Party.
Right.
But in that year, when the Democrats under Lyndon Johnson, after the Kennedy assassination, pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and began to abandon segregation for cross-racial and cross-ethnic partnerships, and the Republicans simultaneously nominated Barry Goldwater, who opposed the Civil Rights Act as a usurpation of states' rights. The parties sharply did a U-turn, unprecedented in history. The first Republicans sprang up in a South where they didn't even have Republicans before that. I grew up there. I was there. Republicans were scarce as polar bears. They were Yankees. But as soon as Goldwater announced that he was against the Civil Rights Act, the first Republican candidates sprang up in the South where they hadn't existed, and when it was no longer respectable to defend segregation, they began to cuss government, and they've been doing it ever since in the voice that is that defines to this day phrases from the 1960s about big government and biased media trying to concentrate power in Washington. And the Democrats have been struggling ever since in politics. So race is a very, whether it's spoken or not, it's still a very, very powerful influence in our politics. All you have to do is look at voting patterns.
You know, Taylor, and you write in this book, as you have in your other three books that came out, that Lyndon Johnson, then the president, knew exactly what the consequences of these different moves by the two parties. He knew what the consequences were going to be in the years going forward.
Yes, he said to an aide when he passed that bill and then went forward with the Voting Rights Act the very next year, that it will cost our party the South, and not just for this generation. I mean, he knew it would take a while for the country to adjust. And that's really what I'm hoping will happen, why I put out this short 190-page compact version of my long trilogy,
mm-hmm.
To help people see that this was a great watershed, but actually the changes that have come since for women, for minorities, for elderly, for the disabled, things that didn't really exist have been good for everybody, including the white South, which has become prosperous once it shed the burden of segregation. There wasn't any Sun Belt when it was segregated. And that this has been good as a model, that race is really a doorway of learning how to tackle our problems in common.
Hmm.
And that's why I think the civil rights movement, properly studied, which I hope will be done, is a model for the future, not just about something from the quaint past over, you know, who sat where on buses.
We're visiting with historian Taylor Branch about his new book, The King Years. You know, as an historian, Taylor, who has just immersed himself in race and racial politics of this country going back so many decades, I'm wondering, do you ever sit back and wonder at all that's gone on, not only in American history, but in world history, I guess, in a sense, just based on the color of people's skin. You know, I wonder if someday, centuries from now, what people will think of us when they look back at all the machinations and stuff we've been through just because of race.
Just because of race, just because of difference, just because in really, in a larger sense, the other. A lot of politics is about who's the other, which instills fear in humans, and that's natural. But democracy itself is about learning how to get along with strangers and making them not the other in a sense that you can cooperate and build things. That's the ultimate essence of our strength. And so I hope one day we will look back on how ridiculous it is. In a way, a lot of us don't really want to remember because if we were on the wrong side of the segregation issue, it's embarrassing to have been a segregationist. And for black people, it's embarrassing to remember being humiliated. And so the lessons from this era are not always easy to recover, but they are really, once you remember and go through the fact that in these United States, not so long ago, it was illegal for black people to use the public library or play checkers in public in large parts of this country, and nobody was against it until the movement came along to make those issues stark and clear and the promise of democracy, we realize how far we've come, and we need that kind of confidence to tackle our economic and other problems today.
Taylor Branch, in this new book, The King Years, you picked 18 seminal moments for this latest volume, 18 seminal moments from the Civil Rights Movement. Is there one moment of the 18 that sort of outweighs all the rest that is perhaps the most significant moment of the entire era?
Well, I would say the one from the summer of 1964 when you see Lyndon Johnson realizing that he was what was at stake when he went through the door and said, "We really mean it when we mean all citizens are equal, that nobody's too foreign to be, you know, a fellow citizen."
And again, this was a
president.
He literally
had a breakdown in the White House. He hid under the covers for 3 or 4 days. He thought he was going to turn into Woodrow Wilson, who had had a stroke back in World War One, because he was so nerve-wracked, and because the Southerners abandoned him, and black people thought he wasn't going fast enough, and Southerners thought he was going too fast. And the President of the United States, part of this story that it is literally that when you are in his shoes and he knew what he was doing, you can see him have a breakdown, and that's a very dramatic moment at a crossroads in our history.
You know, Taylor, it's almost hard for folks today to appreciate just how important a moment that was. This was a Texan, a president from Texas, making this declaration that we shall overcome, using the words of Martin Luther King, and so many Southerners and many Americans all across the country, for that matter, stunned at Johnson's commitment to reform for civil rights.
Yes, that was in his Selma speech in 1965.
Right.
In that same speech, he put it in the context of American history that Selma was a moment like Concord in the Revolution and like Appomattox in the Civil War, and that the people who had been beaten on Selma's Pettus Bridge were like them, a moment that puts together the test of human nature against our principles that, you know, we're all equal citizens. And so it was very, very profound. Not only did he say we shall overcome, but in that speech he recognized that a black-led movement was not only at the heart of American patriotism, but kind of the vanguard at that moment. And that's still, a lot of people don't really accept that. They want to try to see this moment as something that's not really about them. But it's really about all of America, and we're all the better off for it.
Yeah, let's turn to the first big moment that you highlight here in your new book, The King Years. And this one is the speech that Martin Luther King made on the first night of the Montgomery bus boycott. This is back in 1955. Set the scene for us, Taylor, because tell us just how little time King had to prepare for his first big step into the national spotlight, and even take us into King arriving home in the hour before he gave this big speech and telling Coretta that he's got to move and move very quickly, and tell us that terrific story.
He comes home. He says, "I don't have time for supper. They've just made me the head of a new committee to try to explain this boycott that's just started. I don't know what to do. The more senior past preachers in Montgomery had decided that this boycott probably was going to be a failure, so they wanted the new kid in town, who was only 26, to lead it. They drafted King, and so he grabbed his coat. He normally spent 15 hours preparing a sermon, but he walked right out the door to this church for a mass meeting of all the black people in who were then called Negroes in Montgomery. And when he got near there, he couldn't even get in the church, and he was kind of awed and said this could turn into something big because there were thousands of people outside the church, and the church was packed. And he had to go up there and explain what they were doing and what he wanted them to do. And
they ended up putting up loudspeakers so folks outside could hear, right?
Right. And inside the church, he goes up there and he faces them, and he doesn't know most of them. He's new in town. He's got the little kind of educated church, and he's a doctor, but this is mostly day laborers and maids and sharecroppers all around there, and he is groping for words to try to cement what to do. And so you can feel that in the speech. That's what I try to describe, because he discovers a communion and some lines work, and then he's explaining theology to them, and they're cheering theology. And the communion between him and an audience really is moving, and which, of course, is the beginning of the word movement. We're talking about the civil rights movement, but every movement grows into history. That grows into history has to start with people being quietly inspired. And in that sense, this first chapter shows and recaptures the moment when Martin Luther King became a public person by virtue of his communion with his audience, because he was first and foremost an orator. So that was the beginning of the civil rights movement on the first night of the Montgomery bus boycott.
This is so interesting to me, this moment we're talking about, because you describe in the book this notion that King, the preacher, typically needed hours to prepare for one of his sermons. And here at this pivotal moment that really launches him in so many important ways, he had mere minutes. And he arrives home, tells his wife, Coretta Scott King, that, hey, I don't have any time for dinner. He goes off into a study, closes the door, and manages in just a few minutes to find something to hang this speech on. We were going to play a clip from it, but the audio quality is so poor, as you might imagine, going back, something just made, I think, by who was who taped that speech that night, Taylor?
A blessed anonymous person on a big reel-to-reel recorder. And I found it in the archives, and I'm forever grateful, because otherwise it would not have been possible to capture the description of the way he related to the audience.
Let's move on to another seminal moment just quickly here. I want to get to the March on Washington from 63. Obviously, this is the march when King delivers his I Have a Dream speech. You describe how nervous the nation's capital was to have all these African Americans descending on the Capitol at once. What was the thinking then?
Well, it illustrates a point I made just earlier, that we don't really want to remember how nervous we are about race or how bad we are, most people. The city of Washington canceled alcohol sales 2 days before the march for the first time since Prohibition. They stockpiled plasma. They had paratroopers outside the city, just assuming that you couldn't have large numbers of black people in the Capitol without riots. And the most telling thing to me about the state of the fear was that Major League Baseball, several days before, canceled the Washington Senators game in advance, not only on the day of the march, but the day after the march.
Wow.
They canceled two baseball games because they assumed that we would still be cleaning up, from the disaster. So that's how nervous we were. And in a way, because it was such a patriotic event and because it was so peaceful, we emphasized that and how sweet the I Have a Dream speech was, in part at the media at the time, because it helped cover our embarrassment that we had expected something so different.
And again, a pivotal moment here, because King delivers this speech. so remarkable, but he doesn't stick to the text. He veers off in the moments that we remember so clearly when he speaks about having a dream. And again, a key moment, there's a woman in the audience behind him, Mahalia Jackson. Do I have that right?
Yes, you Taylor. Do. The queen of gospel.
The queen of gospel, who says to him, as King begins to get going, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. And not long after that, King veers off his prepared text and delivers, of course, a speech for the ages.
Yes, all of the parts of the I Have a Dream speech that are popular in memory that we retain, the Let Freedom Ring and I Have a Dream, were at the end when he went off the prepared text that he wrote and basically preached the way he normally did, which was more or less like a jazz musician. He was an orator, and he had tried out riffs, and he knew that they worked, and the I Have a Dream speech, he just stitched some of them together at the end. So this great seminal speech, ironically, is more or less an improv speech that he did, hundreds of times of every year from podiums across the United States.
Well, Taylor, you have delivered a work that's going to last for decades, and I hope you feel as good about it as so many of your readers have over the years. What a great contribution you made.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It's for students of freedom and teachers of history. I'm really hoping that it will help history teachers in colleges and high schools transmit this inspiring story to a new generation.
That's Taylor Branch's new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Taylor, it's always a pleasure to have you. All the best.
Thank you. I enjoyed being there.